Any questions from discussion group anyone would like to bring up? Sure.
The names of the two highest rows, their powers?
The names of the...
The powers of the two
Yeah. What the names are?
Yeah.
They're all listed on the back.
Oh, yeah.
There's the hearing, thinking, mindfulness, introspection, effort, and familiarity.
Thank you.
We had a question about sort of the integration of samatha practice into daily life.
Yeah.
Is it something that would it be appropriate, for example, if you find yourself in a stressful situation, you get that, although it's not full practice, but to sort of, you know, mentally step back, concentrate on your breath, you know, is that really part of the intent, really, of samatha practice? To be
very
to
good.
Okay,
yeah. So one of the key elements in continuing to cultivate this practice in daily life is, again, the mindfulness, is to simply be present in our daily activities. And that can take a number of forms. I mean, of course, it's good in the morning to set the motivation to be mindful in all of our activities, but probably we're going to forget that. So often what can be helpful here is to use triggers, to trigger. Something to trigger us, to remind us to be mindful. That can take a number of forms. One, of course, is to pick certain activities that we do regularly and really always be consciously present, mindful, like brushing the teeth, you know, being aware of the sensations of the gum, on the gums and so forth. And another one, a very good one, is when we're eating meals, to be really tasting and not be gulping it down, thinking about all the things we got to do for the rest of the day. So pick a couple of activities and really make that conscious effort in those activities. Together with that, then we can also use technology to help us. You know, sometimes in the past, of course, people have digital phone, and then you can set it to beep on the hour. So when you can set that, and so when it goes off, then you simply stop whatever you do and then do a little mindfulness exercise. Simply be aware of the breath for 3 breaths or a minute or something, or just look at the state of your mind for a minute or two. I mean, you don't need more than a minute or two. Or now, of course, most of us have smartphones, iPhones and so forth, and there's plenty of apps that do the same thing that randomly sent off. You know, there's one called, mindfulness. I forgot the name of it now, but anyway, there's lots of them available. Yeah. Insight Timer. Yeah, that's one of them. And there was another one I'm thinking of, but it's the same. It basically just sends off a little alarm at a random interval, and then when you hear it, then you simply, for a very short time, do a very little mindfulness exercise. So this can also help us to get in the habit of being mindful. And another way, a trigger, is when you, like you said, you have some strong mental affliction or arising, is then just stop and just be present and observe that. And then, of course, that will help to dissipate it as well. So we can use these triggers in this way. Okay. So let's then go back and continue on where we left off. So we're still talking about the shamatha practice, the concentration practice, and we were looking at these 9 stages on the way to shamatha. And the shamatha that we were talking about is the diagram up in the middle at the top, where we said that we go through this physical and mental pliancy, serviceability or flexibility of body and mind. That's the transition from the 9th stage up to shamatha. And then it said when we achieve shamatha, then we are experiencing 3 qualities of mind. That experience of shamatha has 3 qualities. Oh, is that we experience clarity, non-conceptuality, and bliss. And that in our shamatha practice, as we are improving in our shamatha practice, then we're going to start to have little experiences of these three qualities. Sometimes in our shamatha practice, our mind will seem really vividly clear. At other times, it will seem very still. Other times, we'll have a lot of joy or bliss arising in our meditation. And as I mentioned earlier, the meditation texts warn the meditator about these three experiences because they're very pleasant and it's very easy to get caught up in them. And that when we have these experiences, to start craving them and try and recreate them in our practice. And this is just going to lead to a lot of frustration and disappointment, I know from personal experience. So when these things come up, or even when some strange or unpleasant experiences come up, is don't get caught up in your experiences. Don't get caught up in craving and attachment to pleasant experiences. Don't get caught up in aversion, fear, worry, anxiety about any strange or unpleasant experiences. These will come and go a lot in this practice. Simply keep to the instructions of the practice. And so then, what is the measure of achieving shamatha is this pliancy, which is mentioned here in your text. So if we go into page 37, it says, sort of halfway down, the measure of successful cultivation of serenity or shamatha. And the first outline says, if pliancy is not achieved, this would be an approximation of meditative serenity, but would not be genuine serenity. What is pliancy? Which we looked at Alan Wallace talking about that earlier. It is a serviceability of the body and the mind due to the cessation of the continuum of physical and mental dysfunction, and it has the function of dispelling all obstructions. And then it goes on in the next thing, in the next paragraph here, talking about the marks associated with attention, meaning what sorts of things will we notice when we achieve shamatha. So there's a number of things here, so let's have a look through them and see what they mean. So the first one is, it says, the achievement in small measure of the four. Your mind belongs to the form realm. So remember that our mind now is caught up in this desire realm. And that when we develop this concentration, we sort of go beyond this desire realm's type of mind, and our mind actually now is part of the form realm. So we've sort of transcended desire in terms of not eliminating it, but that state of mind now has gone beyond desire or attachment, and the mind itself actually belongs to the form realm level of existence. And then, of course, also we have here this physical and mental pliancy and one-pointedness of mind. So we now have single-pointed concentration. The second point is here, the ability to purify afflictions. So remember here, with this level of concentration, then we can now, through our vipassana practice, coming to realize the nature of reality, we have now the ability to start to eliminate the mental afflictions. So that's what it means, the ability to purify afflictions. The third one says, once your mind is established inwardly, meditative equipoise and physical and mental pliancy arise ever so swiftly. So again, when we sit down to meditation then and bring our mind inward, then meditative equipoise here, equipoise means balance. So generally, often in the Vipassana section of text, and they say you're in meditative equipoise on emptiness. Meditative equipoise is, again, balance, is talking about this shamatha level of mind. So it means that Once we've achieved shamatha, and then we sit down and we bring our mind inward, then very quickly do we get back into that completely balanced state of mind. And then the physical and mental pliancy arise again very easily. Then the fourth one, it says, the five obstructions, such as sensual desire, for the most part, do not occur. The five obstructions, there is, of course, the two of laxity and dullness and distraction, which means in our daily life, these don't really come up so much. Our mind is very alert and focused most of the time. The one that's mentioned here is sensual desire or craving, and the other one related to that, of course, is the opposite of malice or ill will. So because of the power of concentration, the mental afflictions in general, but in particular these two sort of attachment and aversion, are very much subdued, very much dormant. And the fifth one, I think, in this list is doubt. And then the fifth one, it says here, when you rise from meditative equipoise, you will still possess physical and mental pliancy to some extent, meaning that outside of meditation, you'll still maintain to some degree this flexibility and serviceability of body and mind, which I think is a great thing, of course. So these are some of the marks or signs that will occur when we achieve shamatha. But then, of course, very important in the next sentence, which I've already mentioned, it says, do not regard every occurrence of bliss, clarity, and non-discursive awareness as meditation on emptiness. So, again, it's very easy that when we get into this state, because what you'll find also in the Vipassana practice, then when it describes a realization of emptiness and the state of mind, we see similar words used. And so therefore, when we have these qualities arising in our shamatha practice, then it's very easy for us to misinterpret that and think we're having some deep transcendent realization of nature of reality. So therefore, we need to be careful that just because our mind is very clear, blissful, and non-conceptual does not mean that we have realized emptiness or nature of reality. So very important not to misinterpret this experience here. Any questions? Yeah.
Can those episodic experiences in shamatha where you might experience, you know, something that feels a little bit like, you know, emptiness, can those have some sort of lasting impact as isolated instances in your life, or are they just something that comes and goes and doesn't really, you know, it's no different really than any other?
So remember I talked earlier about the three stages of practice of this Golnyam talk of intellectual experience realization. So here, of course, we're having these various experiences, and also we can have unpleasant experiences as well. Then these experiences, of course, depending on the level of experience, will depend on how they are affecting us outside of meditation. And as a beginner, these sorts of little experiences will be very fleeting, and they really won't have so much residual impact on us. But of course, as we deepen our shamatha practice, then some of these marks that we looked at here will start to be more significant and more lasting. So we will notice then that from the shamatha practice, then, for example, we may notice that our mind naturally becomes more still in daily life, seems to be more clear than normal usually, and quite joyful, blissful. So yes, as we progress in the path, in the shamatha practice rather, these sort of qualities, their impact can last longer in the daily life.
So number two, the ability to purify afflictions, is that specifically the 51 mental afflictions?
Well, just mental afflictions in general. And in that list of 51, there was 26 were mental afflictions, remember?
I've been trying to find that list, and I haven't. Is that,
There was someone had the book here, Geshe Rapton book.
Yeah,
it's all there. In fact, that's one of the best books to use if you want to look for.
It's useful to get familiar with what they are.
Yeah, of course. It's yes. Good idea.
Good to identify.
Good. Yeah. Yes. Very good. Okay. Yeah.
I'm curious about clarity. In terms of, and again, I'm a beginner at meditation, so clarity. I think I'm struggling with that. With also thinking like, then I shouldn't have thoughts, or then I shouldn't. Frequency of thoughts, or I shouldn't
react to thoughts? No, clarity is more the quality of attention.
Okay. So
this, I mean, non-conceptuality here is, in shamatha practice, really talking about when there is stillness of mind.
Okay.
Whereas this is talking about the quality of attention. Whether the mind is still or there are thoughts, then our perception is very clear.
Okay.
Yeah.
Can I use focus? Is focus another? Or is that not
focus? Not really. This is quality of focus.
Okay. Thank you.
So, if you have an experience, don't make too big of much of a deal out of it.
Correct.
However, I mean, do you just drop it then? Or I guess, I mean, the thought is that when things happen, it's like, oh, this might be a chance to actually go somewhat further. If I don't do anything with this, it's just going to collapse back into whatever before.
Yeah. So again, what we can do is use these various experiences as markers of progress and then be inspired that we're making progress and then put more effort.
Do you kind of need a teacher to interpret things properly at that point?
I mean, really, as we go on this path of shamatha, if we go... See, one of the things is, in general, and particularly I think in our modern society, we suppress so much stuff. I mean, and as we go on the path of shamatha, it's really like a healing practice. So you're going to find like a lot of stuff will come up. And if you really get in this practice quite intensively, then you're going to be dredging up very subtle stuff. And it's good to be able to have a qualified teacher to work through that. Because of this suppression, of course, is just hurting us. So it needs to come out and to heal it. And so you'll find that once you get well established in this practice and putting a lot of time and energy into it, then it's very helpful, of course, to have a qualified teacher for that. But also what you'll find is that by... stabilizing the mind, you'll find that also the subtle energies in the body, which are now completely out of whack, will start to balance. And in that rebalancing, you'll get all sorts of physical experiences coming. You know, some of them are very pleasant. You know, you get this sort of blissful flow of sensations. Some of them, you know, like you feel like you're levitating and your body's big, small. I mean... some of them are like electrical shock. I mean, you get all sorts. In fact, in these sort of texts, they often give a list, you know, huge list of what's possible experiences physically, all sorts as possible in the body and the mind. And then at the end of the list, they say exactly the same thing. Don't get caught up in these experiences. Don't get caught up with craving the pleasant ones or having aversion, fear, anxiety, worry about the unpleasant ones, because your whole practice will come to a grinding halt. So just let it go, let it go. These things, experiences will come and go, come and go, come and go. Of course, in meditation, if in every session there's some sort of physical, particularly physical experience that's unpleasant, then we need to check, well, am I got something wrong with my posture or I'm being too tight or something. But other than that, then you'll find that these sorts of experiences will come and go, come and go, come and go.
Well, what if they're stable for a period? I mean, I flip the switch.
Well, these ones will become more stable. These sorts of experiences will become more stable because this is really the conventional nature of the mind. And so we're tapping into that more and more. So these will stabilize.
It's still teachers, the key thing.
Sorry?
Yeah,
I think if we really want to dedicate a lot of time and effort into this practice, then it'll be more helpful to have a qualified teacher to guide us more closely. Okay. Then on this chart here, there's a couple of extra things I just want to finish off with before we move on to the Vipassana section. In the middle of the chart, there are five little diagrams here. For example, down toward the bottom, you have a bowl of fruit. So these five diagrams here are the five sense objects, because the most common form of distraction, again, is the sense pleasures, this excitement, and that is these symbolizing. So the bowl of fruit, of course, is taste. Next to it, we have some silk cloth, so that's touch or tactile objects. Above that, we have two round objects. They're symbols, so that's sound. And then beside that is a shell, a conch shell with perfume in it, so that's smell. And then a little bit above that, diagonally above, a round object is a mirror. So that is, of course, visual objects. So these are the five sense objects that are the most common form of distraction. And then, as I already mentioned, number 19, we have the monkey in the tree. And remember, number 19 was basically saying that if in the middle of shamatha practice you have a virtuous thought about helping someone or compassion or something, then this is not the right time to entertain that thought, that this is actually an obstacle, we need to let it go. Of course, other times we need to actively cultivate those sorts of positive states of mind. And what I mentioned earlier, and I'll mention again, is that you will find that when you engage in the shamatha practice, particularly as you get deeper into the practice or maybe even do a short retreat on it, and as your mind really starts to become very calm, clear, and blissful, then you're going to find all sorts of fantastic ideas will start popping up. But that in the middle of that meditation is not the right time to entertain these thoughts. And then simply if it pops up, just say, okay, that's very important, or that's a great idea, I'm going to look at that after the meditation. And if you're worried about forgetting, have a little notepad and just jot down a few key words and then let it go and look at it later. Otherwise, you're going to be constantly coming up with these great ideas and constantly getting pulled away from the shamatha and you won't get any further. So, and then the last point I want to mention is the last diagram up in the top right-hand corner. Here we see the meditator now with a sword in their right hand. This is the sword of wisdom. So this diagram, of course, is talking about the Vipassana practice. And if we look, there's two numbers there, 32 and 33. And on the back page there, the next page, it says, the root of samsara is cut by the union of shamatha and vipassana, observing emptiness. Equipped with mindfulness and introspection, seek the correct view of emptiness. So therefore, on the basis of our shamatha stable, clear mind, we can seek the correct view of emptiness. And of course, we need to put effort now to investigate. So therefore, we have the flame is back here, meaning we need to now put effort to investigate the nature of reality, and then to be able to cut the root of samsara, ignorance, and the mental afflictions, we need to have this shamatha and vipassana unified. And what it means for that is coming up in this text here later. We'll be looking at that tomorrow. So that's all I really wanted to cover on the shamatha practice and this chart. Any last questions about shamatha practice before we move on to vipassana practice? Yeah.
I'm sorry, you said, but I forgot, when the elephant turns his head forward,
when he's turning his head back,
right?
It means coming back to the object quickly.
Okay.
So by stage three, we can quickly come back to the object.
Okay, and on stage five, when his head's the other way?
Well, by stage five, we never lose the object, so there's no question about coming back, because we're never gone. We're never gone.
And you said the monkey was conceptual, discursive.
Well, discursive thought in general, and the blackness is the excitement. See, that's why the monkey in the tree is not black. And so therefore it's saying that this discursive thought, even if it's virtuous, at the time of shamatha is an obstacle. Yeah.
You might have said the ninth stage is attained through the power of familiarity. Could you explain what that means a little?
Yeah. So the familiarity means that basically it becomes spontaneous. That before that, the fifth road, the power of effort, is for stage 7 and 8. So in stage 7 and 8, we still need to apply a little bit of effort, particularly at the beginning of the meditation to get it going. But then at some point, it becomes completely spontaneous. We've become so familiar with this practice that it's spontaneous. So that's what familiarity means. Okay?
As one progresses through the path, do the stages... intervals, can they get more difficult or more easier?
I mean different challenges at different stages.
Right.
And then actually one point on that is, what does it mean to be at a particular stage? What it means to be at, like, say, stage 3. Remember, stage 3 is we can hold the object maybe 5 or 10 minutes, and then when we get distracted, we quickly come back. So if that is our average experience, we're at stage 3. In some meditations, we may be able to hold the object the entire session. In some others, we maybe get a little bit more distracted. But if that's our average experience, then we're at stage 3. So individually, there could be sessions where we're 1 or 2 stages ahead or 1 or 2 stages behind. But on average, if that's our average experience, then we're at that stage. That's what it means to be at that stage. Okay, so let's now look at the Vipassana practice. Just one more point here. We see that Vipassana is coming on the basis of shamatha. But that doesn't mean, of course, we need to achieve shamatha before we begin our Vipassana practice. But what it means, of course, is that if we don't put any effort into our shamatha practice and then we try to do vipassana, we're not going to get very far. And that if we want to unify them, then we need to have achieved shamatha before we can unify it with vipassana. Okay, so let's go over onto page 38, how to train in insight. So again here, insight is the translation for the Sanskrit word vipassana or the Pali word vipassana. And in that paragraph there it says, as I have explained, meditative serenity or shamatha has the features of non-discursiveness, so that's what I've put down here as non-conceptuality. When your attention is intentionally set on a single object, it stays there. Two, clarity, that it is free from laxity, and 3, benefit, i.e. delight and bliss. So these are the 3 qualities that I mentioned here. However, you should not be satisfied with just this. Rather, developing the wisdom that properly determines the meaning of reality, you must cultivate insight. The darkness of confusion is not overcome until the knowledge of reality dawns, but it is overcome when that knowledge arises. Then we go down a little bit in terms of, the first paragraph there, fulfilling the prerequisites for insight. It says, you should listen to the stainless textual systems, relying on a scholar who accurately understands the key points of the scriptures. For without a decisive view of how things exist, you cannot develop insight that knows the real nature, emptiness. And then we have 2 outlines here talking about provisional definitive meaning, and then it talks about Nagarjuna here. So when... Yeah?
So what you just read, is that it's talking about studying getting a conceptual understanding of emptiness?
A conceptual, yeah, that's what we're going to see is coming, is to come to have a framework for practice, to have some understanding, some framework, so then we can apply that to the practice, yes. Then here, these two paragraphs basically saying is that the Buddha taught according to people's capacity, and particularly here in terms of ignorance and nature of reality, then he taught a number of different levels of understanding. And from that, we have in ancient India a number of different philosophical schools emerging. And one of those was the Majjhimika philosophical system, which is what we are going to be following here. And that came about because of this great Indian master, Nagarjuna, from the 2nd century. And what he did, he wrote a classic text called Mula Majjhimika Karika, or The Fundamental Wisdom of the Middle Way in English. And he wrote this text based on the teachings of emptiness that the Buddha gave in these Perfection of Wisdom sutras. And so it's on the basis of this text that the philosophical system of Majjhimika evolved. And this is going to be the philosophical system that we are going to be following here in our discussions. And so again, here in this philosophical system, then the deepest level of ignorance that we have to overcome is this grasping onto independent me, independent objective world. And we are to come to realize there's no independent me, no independent objective world, and this is what this idea of emptiness is, or in Sanskrit, shunyata, is emptiness is the fact that everything is empty of independent existence. So then, how do we determine this philosophical view of emptiness? There's a paragraph titled The Stages of Entry into Reality. So let's have a little read of that and see how we go about this. It says, first, having contemplated in dismay the faults and disadvantages of cyclic existence, you should develop a wish to be done with it. Then, understanding that you will not overcome it unless you overcome its cause, you research its roots. You will thereby become certain from the depths of your heart that the reifying view of the perishing aggregates, or ignorance, acts as the root of cyclic existence. So remember here again, we're talking about what is underlying this current state of dukkha, which of course is our mental afflictions, and at the root of our mental afflictions is ignorance. And here, in this Majjhimika system, then if we investigate, we'll come to see that this root ignorance is this grasping onto independent me, independent objective world. And that is often here talked about by this, what's called the reifying view of the perishing aggregates. So remember, that was one of those five wrong views. And this was, again, the perishing aggregates, of course, is the body and the mind. And the reifying view of them is grasping on the body and the mind as being the me, the person, the self. So this is grasping on to independent person or self. Next, see that overcoming the reifying view of the perishing aggregates depends upon developing the wisdom that knows that the self, as thus conceived, does not exist. So to overcome it, we have to come to realize that this self, this independent me, does not exist. After you have thus arrived at the philosophical view that discerns that the self and that which belongs to self lack even a shred of intrinsic nature, you should accustom yourself to that. This will lead to the attainment of the embodiment of truth. So again, we are to understand this view and then apply this in meditation to come to experience and realize there is no independent me. Nothing exists independently. And if we familiarize ourselves with that, particularly the direct realization of that, we can overcome all of our mental afflictions and all of our suffering. And how that process works, we're going to talk about tomorrow afternoon. Yeah.
They say that the I is merely imputed on the five psychophysical aggregates. What does that mean? Just that it's a label?
That is, we're going to start to talk about very soon. And we're going to talk more about that tomorrow. So I'm going to start to talk about this afternoon and carry on about that tomorrow.
But this is saying you need to think about this again and again? Or
well, you need to come to understand, and that's what we're going to come up to here, is to come to first see how we, what are we grasping at now? What is our, how do we believe things exist now experientially? So the key in all of this, of course, is that to come to see how we falsely see reality now, and then to come to see that, in fact, it is a false way of seeing reality, and then come to see that we can overcome that, and then use that within meditation to come to realize how things really exist in meditation. And then familiarize ourselves with that. And how we do that, that's coming now in the text. Okay. So then we see, very next here, what's called identifying the object of negation. So what does that mean? Or the object to be negated by reason here, it says. In fact, to begin the discussion, let's look at the first sentence here. It says, without contacting the entity that is imputed, you will not apprehend the absence of that entity. Therefore, it is crucial to identify the object of negation carefully, for if it is not identified, you will certainly develop either a nihilistic view or an eternalistic view. So let's see what that really means. So here we can talk about what's called the two extremes. And the two extremes are often listed as existence and non-existence. Existence here means to be grasping onto things existing independently. That this is really where we are camped now. We are grasping onto things existing independently. And the other extreme, of course, is the extreme of non-existence or nihilism, believing that nothing exists. So our job here is to correctly identify how we falsely grasp on to things existing. This is called the object of negation. Because if we don't clearly identify how we falsely see reality, then we're not going to be able to come to the correct view of reality. And so here then, it talks about, in the next section, about the title is here, Refuting an Overly Broad Identification of Object and Negation, and the next, down the bottom of middle of page 39, Refuting an Overly Restricted Identification of Object of to be Negated. What that really means is that we now overinflate how we and the world exists in a false way. we have to clearly identify how we overinflate. Because if we wrongly identify how we overinflate, and we then, so what we need to do, of course, is to take away that overinflation, and then we're left with reality, how things really exist. But the trick is if we don't know exactly how we're overinflating how we in the world exists, then we can do one of two things when we try to strip away that overinflation, is that we strip away too much and then we end up believing that nothing exists, or we don't strip away enough and we're still left with some overinflation. So this is what's talking about this object of negation, is to clearly identify how we overinflate the sense of me and how things exist. Because then if we correctly identify that, we can simply strip that away and then we end up with how things really exist. And if we don't clearly identify that, then one of two things will happen, as it's mentioned here, is either we don't strip away enough and so we're still left with some overinflation, or we strip away too much and we strip away also how things are. So that's like a bit like throwing the baby out with the bathwater. We don't want to do that. So this is what is crucial here. And of course, what we're talking about here in the Majjhimika system, the overinflation, is grasping onto not only ourself, but everything as existing inherently. This idea of inherent existence or independent existence. Or in other words, that what that translates into is then seeing that there is an independent me, independent world, this sort of subject-object duality. So to introduce this topic and how we're going to do this, I'd like to read a little bit from Alan Wallace again, from his Tibetan Buddhism from the Ground Up, page 179. He says the following: many of us believe that we directly perceive objective physical phenomena with our five physical senses, that the mental images we perceive via our senses are accurate representations of the objects we perceive. However, neurologist Antonio Damasio refutes this assumption, which is commonly called naive realism. So now he's quoting the neurologist, who says, when you and I look at an object outside ourselves, we form comparable images in our respective brains. We know this well because you and I can describe the object in very similar ways, down to fine details. But that does not mean that the image we see is the copy of whatever the object outside is like. Whatever it is like in absolute terms, we do not know. Now back to Alan Wallace. He says, in light of this neuroscientific view, with our five senses, we directly perceive images generated in the brain, but these are not truly representations of anything existing independently of the brain. These sensory impressions of colours, sounds, smells, and so on are no more tangible than thoughts or dreams. While we seem to experience colours and so on as they exist in the objective world, independent of our senses, this is an illusion, very much like a dream. Having determined that the reality we perceive depends on our sense faculties, what then really does exist outside our senses? When we close this book and leave the room, shutting the door behind us, what remains? It is an ancient question that has been asked since the time of the Greeks. What exists behind appearances? What really exists out there? This brings up a familiar problem. What happens when a tree falls and nobody is in the forest to watch it or hear it? Most people agree something happened. The tree trunk is on the ground, there is a big dent, things start to rot, and ants and termites live in the fallen trunk. But what happened? Western scientists have traditionally responded to this question by trying to find primary or intrinsic qualities of the falling tree that can be measured. Mass is one of those, the idea being that the tree has a quantifiable amount of stuff to it. Speed is another quality that does not seem to depend on anyone's perception. Briefly considering the history of Western scientific thinking on this point may be a useful digression that may help us better understand the nature of emptiness. Also, by examining our cultural assumptions about the nature of reality, we can better understand and penetrate those assumptions, and by so doing, come to appreciate the Buddhist view. Since Galileo took his telescope and turned it on Jupiter, scientific thought has increasingly depended on the power of mechanical instruments. We get the sense, and it is widely promoted by science, that by using mechanical instruments and mathematics, we stop being subjective and instead become objective. Everyone knows the senses can be misleading, it is said, so let us dispense with the senses. They are only giving us appearances anyway, and we are trying to penetrate through those. The idea of objective measurement came to be strongly emphasized during the time of Galileo, and by the end of the 19th century, scientists felt the objective science of physics was virtually complete. The physics of the time was assumed, with very few exceptions, to be an absolute representation of what was really out there. At the beginning of the 20th century, this view began to break down. Scientists started to understand more clearly that their instruments of measurement were themselves contributing to the data they were detecting. But the real revolution came with the development of quantum physics, which investigates the very smallest components of physical reality. It is here that the participatory nature of measurement and experimentation becomes most obvious. In quantum mechanics, attributes of mass, speed, shape, and location vanish as purely objective entities. All of them can only be seen in relationship to the methods of measurement. As the renowned physicist Werner Heisenberg said, "What we observe is not nature itself, but nature exposed to our method of questioning." As scientists look still deeper, they also started questioning the objectivity of the analytical tools they use. Mathematics, for instance, is one more human creation. Euclidean geometry is only one of a theoretically infinite number of geometries that can be used, and the same goes for algebra and for various logic systems. The subjective element seems to be inescapable on all fronts. In no facet of science, whether we are dealing with astronomy, physics, or medicine, do we get even one bit of information about any reality existing independently of our modes of questioning. All our sensory experience consists of experiences that are contingent upon our sense faculties. Even by reducing everything to the subatomic level of electrons, quarks, and so forth, we are still left with nothing but appearances. What is inescapable is that all that we know of the world, theoretically and empirically, consists of appearances to the mind. We have access to nothing else. Understanding this, the concept of reification becomes universally applicable. In the same way that when we look out on the world and view perceived objects as if they existed inherently in objective space, so too do we view things like electrons and sound waves as if they existed independently of our conceptions of them. Perceived objects exist in relation to the conceptual schemata within which they are understood. We reify an object by removing it from its context, by ignoring the subjective influences of perception and conception. Okay. So let's have a look now how we go about this based on the Lamrim Chenmo here. So again, what we are to do is first identify this object of negation. Identify clearly how we overinflate the existence of things. Because, again, if we don't clearly identify that, then when we try to strip away this overinflation, we're going to either strip away too much and be left with nothing and nihilism, or we're not going to be able to strip away enough and we're still left with an overinflation of existence. So here then, it talks about the problems of stripping away too much or not enough. So I like to reverse the order, so we can go down to page 39, where toward the bottom it says, refuting an overly restricted identification of the object and negated. So here we are not stripping away enough. And so here it says that if you do not understand this and fail to eradicate the perspective of innate ignorance, then when you refute a personal self, you will only refute a self that is permanent, unitary, and independent. When you refute an objective self, you will only refute things that are imputed by the advocates of philosophical tenets, such as objects that are partless particles. So this paragraph is talking about that we have this overinflating of the false sense of me. We have this overinflating of this sense of self, this self-sufficient, substantial, existent self. And we can strip that away, but that's not enough. That's what's called overly restrictive, because even underneath that, there is this grasping onto independent me, independent world. So that object of negation is very coarse. It's not enough. So that's what's being talked about here. But then, of course, if we strip away too much, we then end up in the other extreme of nihilism. So how to overcome this, we can go back up to the first section where we have overly broad identification, where we strip away too much. And here, if we look at the paragraph that is titled Identifying the Distinguishing Feature of Majjhimaka or Majjhimika, it says that the distinguishing feature of Majjhimika is the admissibility of all of the teachings of cyclic existence and nirvana, the agents and objects of production, refutation, proof, and so forth, in the absence of even a particle of essential or intrinsic nature. Thus, Nagarjuna says that it is precisely because of being dependent arisings that phenomena are empty of intrinsic existence. Since certainty about appearances and certainty about emptiness almost never develop together, it is extremely difficult to find the Majjhimika view. So here, what we're saying is that to be able to identify this object of negation clearly, what is this inherent existence or independent existence that we're grasping onto, then and thereby come to a correct view of emptiness, then it is the very fact that things are existing in a dependent way, that things are dependent arisings, that can help us to clearly identify that. So that's what I'd like to do now, is have a look at how understanding that things are dependent phenomena can help us to understand this emptiness, and therefore in that way help us to understand what this really, this object of negation, what is this inherent existence or independent existence that we're trying to identify and then realize does not exist. So as said in the text here, this is the very thing that Nagarjuna was saying that can help us to clearly understand the nature of reality and thereby clearly understand this object of negation that we are trying to realize does not exist, is the fact that it's because things are dependent arisings that they are actually empty of inherent existence, that things are lacking independent existence. So here first, some terminology. Object of negation that we are trying to clearly identify is independent existence. And in the texts, there are a number of terms that are used to describe this. The one here that's most commonly used is this word inherent existence.
And that's the same as independent existence?
Yeah. Yeah. So here, the word inherent existence has the idea that things are self-existent. They have their own unique nature. They exist within themselves. There's another word that is often comes up in these texts in this discussion, and that is existing from its own side. And this has the idea that things existing from their own side has the idea that they do not require an observer for them to exist. They simply exist from their own side. You know, the idea that when we walk in this room, there's already a cup here on the table existing from its own side, that we just come in and confirm, yes, there is a cup here on the table. So that's what existing from its own side means.
Do not require an observer.
Yeah, does not require an observer for it to exist. For it to exist.
For it to exist at all, or for it to exist as the thing that it is.
For.
See, I'm trying to say, because otherwise you fall into nihilism, right? It's like there's something that's there, but for it to exist as a cup, it needs heart. See, otherwise you fall into nihilism, I feel like.
No. There's more to be said here, but I'll leave that for now. There's a lot to be discussed, but I think the answer will come.
Okay.
Yeah. And another term that is often used is true existence. Generally, the word true is meaning something that is accurate, something that does not deceive us. Now, things appear to us to exist independent of us. And if they were, in fact, to exist in that way, they would be true. Meaning the way in which they appear and the way in which they actually exist matches. So that's what true existence means. True existence means existing in the same way in which it appears. All of these three terms, and there are other terms that are sometimes used in the text, all of these three terms are talking about the same thing from a slightly different perspective. So these are three common terms that are used in this context, talking about this independent existence, this thing we're to come to realize does not exist. So here then, to help us is so that we don't strip away too much, we can come to realize that because things are dependent arisings, that's why they are empty of this inherent existence. And this term here, empty of inherent existence, this is emptiness. Or in Sanskrit, shunyata.
Is that translated as voidness sometimes?
Yeah. I think voidness can really, that word, it's easy to think that that means nihilism. Mm. So that was a term that was often used early in the early translations, and it's sort of gone out of favor, I think, because it really is, seems to connotate that nothing exists. Whereas this actually is a very close literal translation of shunyata. And what we're saying here is that things are empty of inherent existence, of course, means they lack inherent existence. They're not inherently existent. They're not independently existent. So emptiness is describing reality in that way. Emptiness is the fact that nothing exists independently. Nothing is inherently existent. Of course, this is not saying nothing exists. It's simply saying nothing exists independently. Why? Because everything exists dependently. That's the word dependent arising. Here the word arising means coming into existence. So things come into existence dependently. So by understanding how things come into existence dependently can help us to understand what emptiness really means. And thereby we can avoid the situation of stripping away too much and end up in nihilism. Because this is really, emptiness is what helps us to overcome the extreme of existence. And dependent arising is really what's helping us to avoid the extreme of nihilism. So, therefore, by understanding this, we can better understand that, and we can find the middle way between these two extremes. So what I'd like to do now is have a look at what does it mean for things to be dependent arisings. There's a question. Okay.
You said emptiness helps to understand the extreme of...
Well, helps to avoid the extreme of existence, because now we are grasping onto things as independent. And emptiness is saying nothing exists independently. But if we don't identify that clearly, then we can simply go to the other extreme of thinking that that means nothing exists. To help us avoid going there, we can understand that things are actually dependent arisings and therefore avoid the extreme of nihilism or non-existence. So, dependent arisings. Remember, a word arising is coming into existence. So, things can come into existence dependently in three ways. The first way in which things exist dependently is they exist depending on causes and conditions. So, for example, this clock here exists depending on causes and conditions. One of the very first conditions necessary was someone in the past needed to think about designing this clock. And then, of course, all the various raw materials needed to be gathered. They needed to be refined. The various components needed to be manufactured. And all those components needed to be assembled. So then, of course, all the factories and people involved in all that, of course, is also necessary. So all of those causes and conditions were necessary for us to have this clock here today. So I think that is fairly straightforward. Then, of course, also things exist depending on their parts. So again, for us to have this clock here, we need the parts. You know, without the plastic frame, without the buttons, the screen, the battery, the electronic components, without all those parts, there would be no clock. So again, I think this one is fairly obvious. But remember here, what we're saying is that this reasoning that things are dependent arisings should be helping us to understand emptiness, that nothing exists independently. But I think for most of us here, we can quite happily accept that this clock exists depending on causes, conditions, and its parts, and at the same time happily accept that when we walk in the door, there's already a clock existing here on the table. True or not?
Yeah.
That should be impossible, according to this logic. Why doesn't that logic seem to have that impact? The reason is, we don't appreciate these two, we only appreciate them at a very superficial level. To appreciate them at a deeper level, we have to understand the third way in which things are dependent arisings. That things exist depending on imputation, labeling, conception, sometimes designation is another word used. All of these things, of course, mean the same thing. So what does it mean for things to exist depending on imputation, labeling, conception, or designation? And then when we look at that, we may think, yes, I think I know what that means. It means there is a single thing here which we're calling a clock. So again, this is a fairly superficial understanding of this third point. To understand the third point a little bit deeper, we can understand that when we look out on the world, what is appearing to us, of course, is just a mass of sense data. And our most dominant sense, of course, tends to be our visual sense. So we're receiving a mass of sense data. And, of course, to be able to function in the world, we have to make some sense or meaning out of all of this data. So what we do, of course, is that in order to have some sense or meaning out of this, what we do is we make collections of data into objects, into meaningful objects, so that we can relate to this in a meaningful way. So what we do is we draw lines around various collections of data and we create objects so that we can make sense, and we have to do that. But we do more than that because we're living in a world with others. So to be able to communicate with others, we have to give names to these things we've created to be able to communicate. So this is what imputation, labeling, conception means. It's this process of drawing a line, creating an object, and giving it a name. Now, how we do this, the way we divide up the world is not fixed. It's completely arbitrary, depending on the meaning that we want to get out of what we experience. For example, how many objects are here?
A bunch.
Well, we could say there's one object, a star. We could say there's two objects, two triangles over the top of each other. We could say there's six triangles. We could say there's six triangles and a hexagon. Or we could say there's 17 lines, a collection of 17 lines. So how many objects are here? Is there 1, 2, 6, 7, or 17?
Nine.
Or hundreds of little dots together.
It's X.
So we determine how many objects are there. They're not already divided into discrete things. So that's what it means to be imputation, labeling, conception. What that means is that in the basis here, there is no star to be found. There is no triangle to be found there. There's no line to be found there. Because we create that by interpreting this collection of data in a certain way. So we bring the star, the triangle, the line, or so forth, into existence through imputation, labeling, conception. Therefore, what we often hear is that the object is not findable. So there is no star, triangle, or collection of or line to be found amongst the bases, because we bring them into existence.
Well, what happens in the minds of creatures who don't label or impute,
like animals? They label, they impute. The process of creating an object is already imputing labeling. Of course, animals, many of them don't have higher level cognitive ability to then give some sort of name to that. But I'm sure when a dog sees a bone, it sees food or something. It has some concept that that is something to be an object to be eaten.
Is that a perception or a conception?
There is both happening. The perception is the data coming in. The conception is interpreting that data in a certain way. I think if a dog couldn't interpret data, they wouldn't know the difference between food and a piece of wood.
You used the word basis, and that sounds like the way we avoided nihilism, because there seemed to be a... You said we brought the star to the basis.
Right, so but... Okay, there's more to be said here. So this is the starting point. This is the starting point. This is coming again. So we're building up to this.
Can you explain the difference between the parts and the conditions?
Yeah. What I'm going to do now is come back to these two based on this understanding. So then we can talk about this as well. I'm not sure if there's something else I wanted to mention there. No. Okay. So now let's go back to these two points and try to understand them based on this understanding here. So this is a timeline, this is a seed, and this is the plant that it produces. So the plant exists depending on causes and conditions. The underlying cause of the plant is the seed. The conditions are the soil, sunlight, water, and so forth. So through those causes and conditions, the seed transforms into the plant. But of course, we believe that things exist independent of us. Therefore, if that's the case, then at what point does the seed become the plant in this process? Because if they exist independent of us, it should be independent of our conceptual framework. So at what point does the seed become the plant in this process? At what point?
Not at all.
Well, it does. It does.
Well, whatever you say, but it's not
exactly.
Clearly, we bring it to the game.
Exactly. But we now believe things exist independent of us. If that was really the case, then it should be a fixed, obvious point where the seed becomes the plant.
Yeah,
but we can understand that's not the case. We can understand that the point where the seed becomes the plant is the point at which this configuration of data stops looking like our concept of seed and starts looking like our concept of plant. And of course, each one of us has slightly different concepts of seeds and plants. So for some of us, this is already a plant, and for some of us, it only becomes a plant maybe down here somewhere. So we bring the plant into existence. So here's another point. We say that the seed and the plant are in a cause-effect relationship. And by definition, if two things are in a cause-effect relationship, they cannot exist simultaneously, by definition. The question is here, does the seed cease to exist before the plant comes into existence? So the question again, does the seed cease to exist before the plant comes into existence? There's only two answers, yes or no. Which is it? So think clearly. Does the seed cease to exist before the plant comes into existence?
No
implies the seed is existing at the same time as the plant, which is illogical if two things are in a cause-effect relationship. So no is impossible. Then if you say yes, the seed has ceased to exist, where does the plant come from?
Right.
Both are illogical.
Right.
So our idea of cause and effect based on independent existence is completely illogical. It cannot work. It cannot work. And so in this text from Nagarjuna, he has 27 chapters of these sorts of arguments. You believe in independent existence? What about the seed and the plant? It doesn't work, does it? What about agent and action? Fire and fuel, all these examples, what about that? It doesn't make any sense, does it? So these sorts of arguments can help us to understand that if we really believe in independent existence, none of these things can work. They become, in fact, illogical. But of course, here, because things are a dependent arising, we don't have this logical absurdity, is that we simply change the label. No problem. Another point that's helpful. We say that the plant exists depending on causes and conditions. The plant exists depending on the seed. Easy. This view is also saying that the seed depends on the plant. How is that possible?
The plant has to put out the seeds.
No.
You see the plant, then you think there is a seed. There was a seed to have this plant.
No, we're talking about the seed now. I think you're nearly on the track.
Anyone?
Exactly. You can't call something a seed unless you have the idea that it can produce a plant. Whether or not it produces it is not irrelevant. You can't call something a cause unless you have the idea of result. So therefore, seed can only exist dependent on plant, because you can only call it a seed if they have the idea that it could potentially produce a plant. Parts. Let's have a look at parts. So we say that, and I'll use this example, it works a bit better. The pen exists depending on its parts. But is there a pen to be found here in this basis? Is that a pen? No. Is this tube a pen? No. Is the plastic tube here a pen? No. Is the ink inside a pen? No. Is the round ball on the end a pen? No. Is the other piece of metal a pen? No. Where's the pen? And people go, oh, that's easy. It's the collection of that. There's the collection. Is that a pen?
Assembled in a certain way.
Ah, yes, the next one. It's got to be in a certain shape. So now you have to tell me, when does a pen come into existence, okay? Anyone? So like the previous example, we can understand we bring the pen into existence when this configuration of data closely enough resembles our concept of pen, and most of our concepts have at least two parts, appearance and functionality. So when this collection of data appears closely enough and seems to function according to our concept of pen, then there's a pen, not before. If this was a pen from its own side, it would mean that if a caveman came in the door here, he'd see pen and start writing with it. I think caveman may see some sort of weapon to stab. And then, of course, if a dog came in here, they may see chewing stick. And then if a tiny ant came along here, they may see a home, somewhere to live. So is this a pen, a weapon, a chewing stick, or a home? It's all and none of them. We determine that. So there's no independent pen. So here is something helpful. Normally we say this is a pen, or that the pen is the collection of this the parts. But this view is saying the pen is merely labelled depending on the collection of parts. So if we can understand that these two statements are not saying the same thing, we're understanding something about emptiness. So again, the two statements are the pen is the collection of the parts versus the pen is merely labelled depending on the collection of parts. And so here is another classic example of cognitive fusion. We have a basis. We have a label. These are two individual things. But what we do is, of course, we fuse the label to the basis. And we say this is a pen. And, of course, another problem with that in general is that the basis is, of course, constantly changing. But the concept or label pen is very static. Therefore, when we fuse the label to the basis, often these changing things, it's more easy to see them as static things, because this is a pen. So this can be very helpful in understanding emptiness, is that understanding that things are merely labelled depending on their parts. Any questions? Yeah.
You've just given me a different perspective on the Christian creation story. You know,
have I?
The universe into existence, you know, basically spoken into existence.
Wow.
By naming it.
Yeah.
I mean, it's very interesting just to think.
Wow. I never thought about that.
This is why I have to say back to the clock really quick. Like there was something I was dying to say. There's a part or a cause or condition that we're missing in the whole thing, which is the theory of time that we think that clock represents. That all of it, if that device, if the year was longer, if it was another planet, if it's the accuracy of the whole thing, the whole nine yards, it's still not what we think it is.
Yeah.
Even though it still is what we think it is, it also isn't. So
the trick here with this view is that, well, it's not a trick, but to understand it is when we go into understanding that nothing exists independently, nothing has inherent existence, then we often fall to the other extreme. And that's what was being said here in the Lam Rim, that having the idea of emptiness and having the idea of an appearing functioning world together is almost, what it say, is extremely difficult to find. So, because for us, there's only two possibilities now. Either there is this real, independent, functioning world, or there's no world. We don't see any other possibility. Because the only world we've identified with and perceived is this apparent, real, independent, functioning world. And so here, when we start to undermine this in meditation and through our reasoning, then it's easy to think, well, nothing really exists then. But this is the throwing out the baby with the bathwater. This is stripping away too much. So again, the dependent arising here can help us to avoid that, is to understand actually that emptiness means that things are dependent arising. And dependent arising means things are empty of independent existence. Because if this cup existed independently, if its inherent nature was to be a cup, it couldn't actually do anything. You couldn't create it, you couldn't change it, you couldn't destroy it. But because this is not in its inherent nature a cup, therefore you can create it, it can function, and you can destroy it. And so here we have another quote from Nagarjuna. He says, in the same text, he says, that which arises dependently and relatedly is explained as simply being empty. And that which is empty is dependently designated. This is the middle way path. So what we can understand is that emptiness and dependent arising are two sides of a coin. And so this is how we can really come to understand emptiness in a correct way and not misinterpret that it means nihilism. In fact, even some very well-known modern-day philosophers who look at Nagarjuna's work say that he's a nihilist.
Yeah, I've read.
Many of them do. They say that's nihilism. So they're saying emptiness equals nihilism. But here we are saying that if we really investigate, that's not true.
So is this maybe an area where there's some translation options too? It seems like emptiness, just the word.
Mm.
You know, there could be better words.
No, in fact, this emptiness is a very literal translation of shunyata.
Uh-huh.
So what we're talking about, when we see emptiness, what we need to ask is, empty of what?
Mm-hmm.
What are things empty of? Not existence. They're empty of independent existence.
Mm-hmm.
That's what we need to ask. So emptiness is describing reality through negating how things don't exist, that they're not independently existent, they're not inherently existent. Because that's what we need to do. We need to strip away that object of negation. We need, through reasoning and practice, to come to realize that that independent existence, which seems to exist, does not exist. That's emptiness, that realization. From that, we will then really come to realize that things are dependent arising, that things are merely labeled, merely imputed. We need to be very careful about this. We are not talking about the psychological fact of whether we happen to be labeling cup. We're talking about level of existence. The level of existence of things is nothing more than existing within conceptual framework, within labeling or imputing. Otherwise, then it becomes silly. You know, if we don't happen to be labeling, then this cup disappears. This is not the meaning. It's talking about level of existence. But one of the problems here that we're going to tackle tomorrow is that when we start to look at things like cups and clocks, then often people have this objection saying, but there's a basis, there's something there, isn't there? To answer that question, then you have to ask, is there a me here? Because often people ask this question with the assumption that there's an independent me here who wants to know that. Of course, if our assumption is there's an independent me, then of course there is something there by default, has to be. The question is there an independent me here? And that's what we're going to look at tomorrow. So, and again, remember, we're not saying there is no me, no person. We're trying to find out how we exist. And as with what we've looked at so far, that the cup is something merely labeled on the parts, the person that does exist, the person that is trying to understand this is merely labeled on the basis of the body and the mind. And we're going to look at that in detail tomorrow. Okay, we've run out of time, so let's leave it there. So tomorrow, of course, we're going to finish off the text, so you can have a look at the rest of your outlines here.